The first step of changeover management is to observe and analyze which of those steps are internal. We have to stop the machine for it. And external is something which, while the machine is running, we can still sort of do it.
Pashi presents The Means of Production, a podcast about what it really takes to build, maintain, and scale the processes that produce the physical products that power our world. Every episode, we ask a manufacturing expert to walk us through the nuts and bolts of how they do their job. We explore how and why they got into manufacturing, dive deep into the hardest problems they've solved on production lines, and discuss their thoughts on what's broken in manufacturing today and how those things can be fixed. This podcast is hosted by me, Sidhit Sanghvi, Pashi's US Manufacturing Operations Lead and former assembly engineer at Ford Motor Company. If you are a part of the manufacturing world and you're interested in being a guest on The Means of Production, get in touch with me at sidhit@pashi.com, which is sidhit@pashi.com. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 14 of The Means of Production. And with me today is a very, very good friend, former batchmate at Virginia Tech and Performance Excellence Manager at Frederick National Laboratory for Cancer Research, Prashant Dhillon. How are you, Prashant?
Good evening. I'm doing well. Hello, Sid.
Well, Prashant, I'm really excited that you could make it. I know you're going through a really busy time, and we're going to talk about all that. But before I do that, Prashant, can you go ahead and read out that disclaimer, please?
Sure. So I work at Frederick National Lab for Cancer Research, but this is my own opinion and is not the opinion of Frederick National Lab, what we will talk about in this podcast. I'm not a spokesperson for this organization, official or otherwise.
Perfect. Thanks, Prashant. So, firstly, can you just tell me and the audience how you're doing, what is going on with you, and all the fantastic things that you're up to these days? And there's some great news to be shared there.
Absolutely. So life is really hectic right now. So we have a new addition to our family. We have our second daughter. Our first daughter is now 6 years old. So technically, we have forgotten everything about raising a child. And so lots of sleepless nights. And you know how the game goes.
Well, congratulations, Prashant.
Thank you.
And what's going on the career front and work front, and what are you doing in that area these days?
Right. So on the work front, actually, at Frederick National Lab, we are setting up this new department or office called the Quality and Performance Excellence Office. My responsibility here is to initiate and institutionalize the elements of performance excellence. Right now, what we are doing is we are doing some pilots with the projects, and knock on wood, they're going in the right direction. Once we gain that momentum, we would kind of leverage and snowball that effect.
That is very interesting to hear, Prashant. And you're my first guest who, currently works at a research laboratory, right? So this is very new for me. And I want you to speak a little bit about that in our first question, in which I asked the guests to kind of trace the journey of how they got into this field in the first place. Because I know that we were together learning industrial engineering, and you've worked in manufacturing environments before. So can you just explain how you ended up here at Frederick National Lab and all the things you did before that, and what made you take this whole path?
Sure. So technically speaking, there are two phases to my life, right? One is associated with manufacturing, and then the life after that. So let me first try to explain how I got to manufacturing itself. So Sid, as you know, I am from a farming family. And, you know, growing up at the farm, we are exposed to fluid machinery such as pumps, compressors, etc., and also the farming equipment. So somehow this exposure led me to pursue mechanical engineering as my major in college. And while at college, as the first flavor of the corporate world, through internships, of course, I got into manufacturing a little bit. For example, I had my first internship with Mazda Swaraj, and then I had the opportunity to co-op at Honda Cars. Later down the road, while at Virginia Tech, when you and I, you know, we were pursuing our industrial and systems engineering, I had another stint with GE Appliances, again, manufacturing. And then my first job in the United States was with a German manufacturing organization. So that's how I ended up in, you know, organically in manufacturing itself. But once I was in this organization, I had the opportunity to kind of, you know, trial and test few roles. I was able to move around within the departments. And soon I realized that I enjoy diversity in projects, and I have a great passion for this cross-boundary collaboration. So this led me to this logical step of stepping into the performance excellence role, first in manufacturing, and then I wanted to see if whatever I've learned in manufacturing can be applied to other industries and sectors. So I first went into construction, and last year I had the opportunity to transition into my current role at Frederick National Lab.
This is quite a journey, Prashant. So thank you for sharing. And looking at your experience, it kind of shows that, you know, no matter where, what the industry is, whether it's manufacturing or whether it's outside of manufacturing, there are certain types of processes at play which are quite similar in the way you look at waste and you look at performance and you look at excellence. And you've kind of demonstrated that it is possible to apply the same general principles of excellence that you learned from manufacturing and apply them in places like construction and also in this role in a laboratory. So it's quite interesting the journey you've taken, and you know, good on you to try such very diverse kind of roles. It also gives, like, you know, people who are just starting their career a picture of what you would do if you wanted to move out of manufacturing, or what if you want to try your hand at different things. And I think your career is something they can observe. So thanks for that description. Now, you've mentioned that you are a performance excellence manager. And I would like to know more about it in terms of the challenges you face. So can you, in the form of the answer for the second question, tell us what kind of challenges you faced and how you went about solving them? And this could be, you know, not just one problem, but it could be like a series of problems. It could be a tough week. It could be a tough year. You know, it could be something that you faced on a continuous basis at any of your previous roles. So what were these challenges and how did you face them?
Sure. So Sid, as I mentioned, you know, I started in a German organization where I had the opportunity to experiment and trial different roles. I moved around and towards the end ended up in the performance excellence role. So as part of the performance excellence team, my responsibility at that time was to create and deploy the operational strategy of our plants within our region to remediate the plant's productivity and lead time issues. To add to this complexity was that our plants were not always in the United States. We had plants in Canada, Mexico, Brazil, etc. And several plants, they would cater to different sectors or different industries. For example, one plant would be catering to furniture, while the other plant would have a product offering for automotive. So this all added to the complexity, to the variability of how we can come up with the operational strategy for these different plants, etc. So to overcome this variation, the way our team went about it was to leverage on a standard framework, or you can call it an approach. We call them as modules. For example, after our standard preparation with any of the plants, we would always start with what we called as analysis, where we would assess all the factors that would impact the output of that particular plant, regardless of which industry that plant is catering to. We would look into their inventories, lead time, scrap, turnover, the quality management systems. We would also look into the production infrastructure, where the market is going, etc. So everything was on the table. We had two things in mind when we were actually doing the analysis. Basically, what does our baseline look like for everything in place? And secondly, we wanted to kind of dig out the opportunities for that particular plant. Next, we would always facilitate what we called as sort of a vision, where we would bring about the teams to create an operational strategy based on the analysis that we had already done. So come to think about it, this sort of set our North Star or the vision for that particular plant itself, where it would want to go in, years to come, 3 to 5 years. And so if you are kind of thinking it through, we have our vision, we have our baseline. Now, all what we have to do is sort of connect the dots, means we have to come up with a deployment plan of how actually we would go from our baseline to where we want to go. So our next step was always to come up with a deployment plan, or third phase sort of a third phase or module. Now, technically speaking, it could be 2 to 3 years, but we always focused or freezed our first year itself. And for the execution of anybody who is in the Lean or Six Sigma field listening to me, we would then leverage on what many people call as action workouts, Kaizen events, rapid improvement events, to kind of go for that execution. And for every workshop, now here is where things were so complex that based on the problem at hand, the tools would change. For instance, if we were dealing with something to do with changeover, we would leverage SMED-related tools. If it was a simple 5S sort of a solution, we would kind of cater to that. If we were tackling with our development team, sometimes we would do failure mode effect analysis, etc. So our tools within our belts would change, but the framework of how we actually went about it, or the methodology, would be very similar to what people refer to as DMEG or A3 thinking. Now, with this deployment, at the end of the day, you also want to kind of see if we are sustaining ourselves or not, right? So at a certain cadence or at a certain point of time, we would always sort of review to see if the approach that we are taking or the execution that we are doing is actually taking us in the right direction, or do we need to kind of change course. So this whole framework was leveraged to kind of give us some stability with this variation of product offering, with the variation of different countries, different plants, etc. And then within those frameworks, many of the tools would keep on changing based on whatever is at hand. So this is something which I thought was very much enriching for my own experience, with that diversity of just the culture, the thoughts, and to add it all, the product offerings.
So Prashant, that was a really good framework you laid out. Can you expand on maybe a particular application or deployment of that framework in a specific example, to just understand what happened in at the 0 feet level, at the ground level, just some nuts and bolts of it.
Yeah, sure, Sid. So before we actually go into the granularity, let's recap of what we have just talked about.
So we have, on a macro level, you know, talked about a framework which helps us to draw a baseline through analysis. It also tries to identify the opportunities that we can work on, right? Through vision, it helps us identify what our goal is, where, you know, the business and where that plant specifically wants to go. And then we also talked about how the deployment plan can be sort of weaved. But where the tires meet the road is the execution. Means that is where things start to take some form. So far, we have just talked theoretically or through meetings and through presentations, right? So I'll walk you through one example, which was what I observed is very common to most of the plants that at least I visited. And I'm pretty sure anybody who's from manufacturing, they might have in their career came across such a problem also, which is a typical problem of changeovers. You know, many organizations, they will have this as one of the opportunities. Hey, we are at X, you know, time figure or timestamp, and we want to actually improve by Y. So in this particular case, as I mentioned earlier, for the granularity, for the execution, we leverage DMEIC, which is Define, Measure, Analyze, Improve, and Control. Now, right. DMEIC is for that specific problem itself. And here, our specific problem is, you know, just as an example, the changeover management. So I won't go through the nitty-gritties of DMEIC. Everybody, you know, many people know about it. I think right. I'll just kind of give the flavor of the changeover management, that what were the big steps sort of involved over there. So when you look at any of the process, let's think about, you know, a good example when we go to either Starbucks or when we look at a pit stop of a Formula One racing car. What we observe is that at the pit stop or, you know, even at the coffee shop, there are many things which are done right at the coffee machine, but then there are many things which are done on the back end. So like that, for any of the manufacturing or any other process, the first step of the changeover management, you know, workshop, or we used to call it SMED, is to observe and analyze that which of those steps are actually internal to the process, or they call it internal elements, or external elements, external steps. What that means is, what are the steps or what are the process steps that we are doing when the machine is down, internal, we have to stop the machine for it. And external is something which, you know, while the machine is running, we can still sort of do it. And the first basic step is to identify, hey, what are, from whatever we do, what is it that goes into the internal bucket? What is it that goes into the external bucket? And you'll realize that it's a mix and match, few of them, you know, that sometimes some steps are internal, then external, internal, external, et cetera, et cetera. But once you do that, then comes the discussion part where, you know, the team sits and I recommend video, you know, goes through the video and thinks about, hey, these were the steps which we were doing when the machine is down, means not productive, production is not getting done. What components or what elements of that portion can we actually transfer to external? What that means is, say for instance, I am trying to change the roller of a specific machine. And for that, I walk to, say, the inventory shop to get that particular roller and come back, and till that time, machine is down. So these are the things which we can think about, hey, it's this step can be actually converted into or channeled into external. This can be done beforehand, or it can be done by somebody else. We don't have to specifically completely stop the machine for such a long time for this, or at least that stopover can be reduced, right? So that's a second step. The second step is trying to understand, trying to kind of brainstorm what internal steps or what internal elements we can actually transfer to external. Now, when you do that, your standard operating procedure also changes. You know, you'll see that there's a bit of shuffling that you have to do. Other questions also start to come into picture, because you'll observe that the changeover per se is not just relying on just that operator. It's more of a systems approach. For that particular changeover to be effective, many more departments or teams have to feed into it in a timely manner. And that becomes a bigger problem, means that becomes a bigger coordination, not a problem, but an opportunity. So once you have at least drafted theoretically that, hey, this is how my transfer from internal to external takes place, and this is how my new SOP may look like, then the next step is, which is step three, is to now start working on reducing your internal. Because see, when is it that we are doing some value add? When the machine is running. And for that, we need to start squeezing that pie off the I portion. And then there's the fourth step, which I have never gotten to, but after when you have optimized your I, you are supposed to go to E and optimize your E. Those are the external steps. So these are generally the steps that you have to take for an effective changeover. And just to give a more general example, coming back to the pit stop, if you observe the videos from 1950s or 60s, you'll see that whenever there was a pit stop, it used to take a lot of time. Don't quote me on it, it was more than 10 minutes or something. But recent videos, if you see, it's less than 5 seconds. And you will see that there's no one team working on it. One team, what that means is the tire team or the fueling team. That's actually a system approach, means all the teams have to coordinate effectively for that change of, for that pit stop to be more effective and to bring that time below 5 seconds.
So Prashant, that was fantastic. I really enjoyed how you explained it. I like the way you went to the specific example in that, you know, in that manufacturing role that you had, but you also took it to a general example that was easier to understand, which was the racing pit stop. So let me just kind of summarize what you said. And this, and I've spoken, you know, about this on the podcast in earlier episodes about SMED, which is single minute exchange of die. And in this case, for SMED, you have used DMAIC as the underlying framework. But for your approach or your module, you had 4 clear steps, right? And in which the first step was observe and analyze the process to know what the internals are and the externals are. And the way you define the internals and the externals were that the internals were things that could happen only at the time of the changeover. They could not happen at any time before. They were, you know, serial, or they were very, very dependent. And the externals were things that could be taken out of this changeover and could have been done beforehand, could have been done in parallel, and so on and so forth. So the first step would be to identify and observe the process to identify these two. The second would be that we would try and transfer as many things that we thought were internal and think about if they can be external. So to take an example from like a changeover of dies, a very general example would be that if I thought that a new die had to be made ready and cleaned up or tuned for or calibrated for the process, I don't have to do it while the changeover is happening. I could have done it like a long time back, or I could have kept it ready. So that would have then become external, right? And that,
absolutely
right. And then the third step is where it starts getting difficult, which is now we have to reduce your internals. So you've converted everything that you thought were internals but are actually externals, and you're happy about that. So those can be done in parallel. But now really reducing the internal is where a lot of the coordination happens, because it affects other things. It affects your standard operating procedure. And this is a point where this whole thing becomes the low-hanging fruits are probably gone, and now you're really reaching for a lot of effort for some improvement. So you are now trying to reduce anything that has to be done during changeover by reducing your internals. And fourth is, like you said, you didn't probably reach to this step, and this could be, you know, also very difficult, which is optimize your external, which is what are the things that I have already transferred to my external or were always external, but I can still optimize a lot of them. So those were the four steps. So Prashant, do you have anything to add to that? Great, great example. Really enjoyed it.
I think, Sid, you explained it beautifully. I can just, you know, add for the clarity of our listeners another example, which is much more general, if they can associate better with this one. Say, for example, our airplanes, right? We always see a changeover happening when we are boarding a plane. Here in this case, the plane lands, comes, and now the passengers have to get out. At that time, our plane is actually on a standstill, means it's not actually transporting anybody yet, right? So the passengers are coming down. This is what you're talking about, the internal, you know, the anything that'll go on that plane at this time will be considered internal. The passengers are moving out. The cleaning crew goes in, starts cleaning. The fuel up crew goes to kind of fuel up the plane. The baggage is kind of taken care of. Also, the maintenance crew is sort of going their own ways, and so is the food and beverage. And then there's the boarding process, right? So all of this is in a way in that I category. Now, the external would be if I am taking, say, too long to package my food material, which has to be uploaded onto the plane, but it's already packed and ready when the plane is here. But when I was actually packaging it, it's taking me longer than normal, right? So that is optimization of E. First, we think about optimization of I, as you mentioned, that, hey, let's first reduce this changeover so that the passengers don't have to wait, the plane doesn't have to sit here for a long time. And then we'll think about the other stuff, which is later on, as you said, you know, let's first take care of the essentials. And once we are done with that, we'll go to optimizing the other layers of the onion. And I, as you mentioned, did not have the opportunity to kind of, you know, get that far yet.
Yeah, that is another good example. I've never thought of airplane changeovers, even though they happen in front of me all the time, as being in the same framework. But I see it, and I hope the audience saw it as well. So thanks a lot, Prashant. Let's get down to, you know, our next question, which is, if you had a magic wand to change one thing about, like, the way you work or your role or, you know, the manufacturing industry in general, you know, what would that be?
Right. That's a really good question, Sid. So, you know, the way our human nature works is when we are working for a specific department, slowly and steadily, we start to kind of have those blinders on where we are thinking essentially within the boundaries of that department itself, right? But when we think about it, the organization is not a standalone department conglomerate. It's more of how the systems are working, right? It's how that department actually fits into the bigger picture and how synergetic things can happen between the departments. So if I had a magic wand, and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that I have a great passion for cross-boundary collaboration, my magic wand would want to kind of reduce these walls of cross-departmental silos. I would love to see people not thinking in terms of the departments, but thinking in terms of the organizations and its common goal. And that way, I feel that we can be more effective and efficient.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Prashant. A lot of the speed is lost because of the loss of communication and, you know, the loss of translation, you know, the translation losses between different departments getting, you know, siloed. And when all of them need to have their, as you know, stake well defined and their involvement from the start, this often doesn't happen. And I think that's a great answer for the magic wand question. So thank you for that. And yeah, go ahead.
So I would just like to add, you know, with the walls coming down, one of the major challenges that most of the organizations also face is of the alignment. Means the top management is generally sure of where we're heading, but are the people sure of it or not, right? Or are they actually aware of it or not? So with this cross-boundary collaboration, etc., the alignment also becomes much more effective or easier, given, you know, there are always those challenges at hand.
Yeah, definitely. So finally, you know, concluding, like the last question, which is like a fun question, is that if this was 2051 and you were able to go into a factory, or if in 2051 your grandchild were to be in a factory, what would they see? What would the factory of 2051 look like?
Yeah, so you're asking a very innovations type of a question, or a creative type of a question from an engineer. So I'll try my best. What comes to my mind is that if I would go into a factory, or if, you know, my child would go into a factory in 2051, they would see first a lot of automation. Secondly, what they would see is reduced inventory sizes, because I would think about, reduction in lead times. I would think about faster changeover times. I would also think about seamless interfaces between all the systems that we have in place. Currently, one of the challenges that, you know, I see within the organizations is that we have different solutions for different aspects. For example, there'll be a different software leverage for production, and then a different one for inventory control. The interface, you know, where the things sort of meet, that's where it becomes very much of a challenge. And I would see this getting resolved a little bit on a more effective scale going forward. So yeah, in a nutshell, I would see, I think, shorter lead times, a lot of automation, effective interfaces.
Yep, that's a great answer, Prashant. And this is not usually often what people say. They are usually talking about like advanced manufacturing kind of concepts. But this is a very important point that you've brought up, which is, you know, you can have very advanced things like, you know, 3D printers or AR, VR. But if you're still going to have the same losses in revenue and the same bleeding that happens due to changeover, that happens due to any of, you know, the mudas or wastes, then that doesn't really help. You know, those things have to be also reduced to as much as they humanly can, and with automation as much as it's even physically possible to reduce them. So I think that's a great thing that you've pointed out, which not often many people think about. For the factory of the future, we're always thinking about the fancy or shiny objects, but not about these tiny things that bleed revenue. So yeah, great answer, Prashant, and thank you so much for being on this podcast and talking to me. And, you know, even though you're so busy with a newborn and you know, doing a lot of other work that's going on, so thank you so much for giving your time and giving us all of these answers and sharing your experience today.
Pleasure is all mine, Sid. Thank you so much.
All right. So take care, and I hope to have you again on this podcast in the future. And stay safe. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the Means of Production podcast for more stories from people behind all the manufactured goods we use, love, and depend on. This episode was made possible by Pashi, the operating system for manufacturing. Pashi unifies the entire production process for any product, encompassing operator instruction and data input interfaces, stage logic and parameter thresholding, machine interfacing and configuration, robot programming and coordination, and stage-to-stage production flow control into a single Pashi program. Check us out at Pashi.com. And until we meet again, have a fantastic day and take care.